Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 67 of the Footmarks podcast. I'm your host, Behram Kazi, who you can find at DefMango on Twitter. And with me, as always, is Jared Kimber, who you can find literally everywhere. And the title for this particular Footmarks episode is South Africa's Spin Bowling Maharaja. You guessed it. It's on the journey of the left-arm orthodox spinner. No, it's not on the Debrees Chamsi. It's on the slow left-arm orthodox spinner who has now the most wickets for any South African tweaker ever in Test cricket. 171 scalps recently overtook Hugh Dayfield, and that is quite an accomplishment, Jared, for Keshav Maharaj, isn't it? Given that spin bowling hasn't been hip in the Rainbow Nation post-readmission in the early 90s.
Yeah, probably even before that. I mean, that's when we noticed it, of course. But I think probably by the late 60s, it was pretty clear they were moving to be a pace bowling team. And if you've only followed them, of course, post-readmission, you know, what are we talking about here? Paul Harris, Pat Simcox, Paul Adams. Like, they're, you know, a lot of Pauls. but, you know, it's never been something that they've really looked at all that much or cared about all that much. And, you know, I remember doing an interview with Paul Harris, and I think he might have been like the spin bowling coach or something. And he was just saying, yeah, we don't really get spin in this country. And he said that he played domestically and, you know, he would bowl around the wicket and would be quite, you know, in his mind, he was trying to be an attacking bowler. And he got to test level and they're like, no, mate, that's not what we need from you. And he ended up being the most dour, boring test bowler of all time, right? Like, watching Paul Harris bowl was, you know, an affront to cricket, really. And that's, you know, that's what they wanted. That's, you know, it wasn't his decision to become that kind of bowler. They wanted someone who wouldn't go for any runs, who would bore people, and then the quicks could pound away at the other end. I don't think there's even if you look at Australia still sees spin as an attacking option. Nathan Lyon will be brought on early, right? And in New Zealand, I think when they have spinners, they're more than happy to, you know, to use them in an attacking way. And that's just, South Africa is probably the one country where we haven't seen that.
Yeah. I mean, watching Paul Harris bowl in Test cricket was probably akin to watching paint dry at times. That's how boring it would get. But I mean, he was successful in his own way, I suppose. Mm. But it's funny how South Africa originally rose to prominence in the cricketing world via their leg spin quartet. And I think they're also known as the four leg spinners of the apocalypse. If I'm not wrong, that's what it is.
Well, that's what I've named them. I'm not sure they're known as that. That's a Jared Kimber.
I thought that was like a four horsemen sort of, term. But no, I liked it.
That was my angle on it.
I like that. But of course, we've probably done a podcast on this before as well, but Reggie Schwartz, Aubrey Faulkner, Bert Vogler, and Gordon White were those four leg spinners. And Reggie, of course, had learned the googly from Bernard Bosanquet at Middlesex, and then he taught us to his peers as well. And that helped South Africa defeat England in a test series for the first time, and then go on, and they went on and did it again, right? It was two in a row, from what I recall. And then after that, after Hugh Dayfield, so that was 1960 was the last time he played, it took them over half a century to produce another spinner who would gain international recognition, and that guy was Keshav Maharaj. So that is quite, like, the whole arc of all of this is quite fascinating.
Yeah, it really is. And as you say, like, the four leg spinners are still, like, I mean, it's a bit of a shame when it comes to South Africa in general, because the players who played before 1970 aren't even considered South African players. But those of us who still look into it, it's like it's not particularly, you know, well known. But you go through, Aubrey Faulkner was their leading bowler when he retired, and I think it took generations for someone to go past him. They had another finger spinner in the 1930s. I'm just trying to get up his name. I think it was Cyril Vincent, I want to say. Yeah, Cyril Vincent. He was a good, handy left arm, you know, finger spinner for them. But they had a bunch of other guys coming through consistently who could take wickets with spin and were involved. And then, of course, Tayfield comes in, and he's incredibly important. But it shows you that spin was still an issue. But they had the same thing happen to them that happens in Australia and happens in England and happens in New Zealand, which is once the wickets get covered, spin really dies up. So, you know, having someone like Cyril Vincent in those days, for if there was a wet wicket, I'm sure Cyril Vincent would dart his left arm finger spinners in a lot quicker. And Tayfield was a brilliant wet wicket bowler as well. But they weren't as suited to the, you know, the browner South African wickets that you get. And then that's kind of it. After, I don't think they have a regular spinner, at least a regular frontline spinner in their side after that period. Like it's like even that last decade, I know they don't play a lot of test matches, but I think even by that last decade, I think they'd moved on from spin a little bit. They had a guy called McKinnon, maybe in the 60s. Yeah, Athol McKinnon. Again, another left arm finger spinner, only played 8 matches. They weren't playing a lot of tests by then because they kind of, it's funny, we now say they were like thrown out of test cricket. It's not quite true. They kind of threw themselves out. But Athol McKinnon was the sort of player that we're more used to now. Athol McKinnon was more like a Robin Peterson type player, you know, could bat, could bowl, Nicky Boye, that kind of player. Yeah. And that's why he was in the side. So even in the 60s, after Tayfield, they'd already moved on to that next thing. And, you know, you think about, if you know anything about the history of South African cricket, you Barry Richards and Pollock and Proctor and the other Pollock, you know, Clive Rice, those are the players we hear about, right?
Yeah.
We don't hear much about great spinners. They did have some great non-white spinners, which, of course, didn't really make it through to any conversation and weren't going to play for South Africa anyway at that point. Yeah. But they didn't. They were producing great cricketers when it came to all-rounders. You know, Tony Greig is another one, of course. They were producing great batters all the way through to, you know, even guys, you know, like Alan Lamb and everyone else. But they weren't producing great spin bowlers all that much in that period. So clearly, once they covered their wickets, things changed quite a bit.
Yeah, and spin bowling was an afterthought in South Africa post readmission. You know, in the 90s and 2000s and then even 2010s or halfway through the 2010s, it's not like anyone was able to make a mark. Of course, you've got your Pat Simcoxes, Nicky Boyes, Robin Peterson, who, by the way, I only learned was originally a left-arm wrist spinner through your piece, who was convinced to start bowling fingerspin because, of course, they wanted to turn the ball away from the right-hander. You know, and that was another interesting one.
I didn't know that either. I interviewed him for Crick Info. And so basically, I'm trying to remember who I talked to. I talked to Paul Adams. I talked to Keshav Maharaj. I talked to Paul Harris. Hey?
Frog in a blender, Paul Adams.
Yeah. He was there. So Paul Harris. I was trying to get hold of Dane Peat, but I think he might have already gone to the USA or something was happening. I couldn't get hold of him. I talked to Robin Peterson. And then I talked to a couple of more domestic-y spinners just to get a bit of a flavor. And it was really interesting how often you had a situation like Paul Harris, where Paul Harris is like, I bowled around the wicket, I pitched a ball in the stumps, I tried to spin it away like a normal left-arm finger spinner, right?
Yeah.
And then you talk to Robin Peterson, he's like, I was spinning the ball in and they asked me to spin the ball away. They just had this idea of essentially left-arm finger spinners, occasionally off-spinners as well, of just drying up runs was the entire plan of South African spin bowling. And as I said before, you look at New Zealand, who I would say have probably produced even worse spinners outside of Vittori in general than South Africa has. That's not the way they think about it. England have struggled with spinners. That's not the way they think about it. Like, it's a really peculiar South African trait. And you go through, and you know, even when they had someone like Imran Tahir, they really didn't know how to handle Imran Tahir because he wasn't one of those players. And, you know, Nicky Boye and JP Duminy, they kind of want that kind of player, right? Robert Peter, to just come in and just sort of dart the ball in for a long period of time and dull it down. But you also have to be a good fielder or a good batter. Yes.
Like, exactly.
They're really at the forefront of thinking that way. And if you go back to England when Duncan Fletcher was coach, Ashley Giles is basically a South African spinner, right?
Yeah.
Can, you know, good big hands in the field, can bat a little bit. He's going to bowl defensively and bore teams out. Like, that isn't really a kind of spinner that England generally have. But when Duncan Fletcher was around, again, sort of Southern African thought process, you have a different way of doing things. So it's a really, it's really clearly ingrained in their cricket culture that is the case.
Yeah, it was a very common trend. Like Boye could bat a bit, Robin Peterson could bat. There could be a case made that at one point Robin Peterson was a better batter than he was bowler, right? And of course,
and think about Dumini. Yeah. Dumini never lived up to his batting potential, but he plays as much as he does. I think in part because of the amount of bowling that they could use him for.
That's true. And even Paul Harris, someone who thought of himself as an attacking, wicket-taking spinner, he became a defensive holder, and then he also retires by age 31 from all cricket. So it really had to take something special by Maharaj to break that trend. And I think that on its own is quite remarkable.
Yeah, and he was the only spinner I talked to. So I talked to Dane Peat after I wrote that original piece for Cricket 4 years ago. I talked to Dane Peat afterwards, and I said to him, oh, you know, there's this big feeling in South Africa that there's the way that they think about spin is really changing. Dane Peat was like, what? No, let me tell you some stories. And I've never got him on the podcast. I should get in touch actually and try and get him on the podcast at one stage. But he's a really interesting guy. And I think he's got a great story to tell at the moment. But Maharaj was the only former spinner I talked to. Even like, I think I might have talked to Shamsi. I don't think I interviewed him, but I think I chatted to Shamsi as well. But Maharaj was the only one I talked to that was like, no. Like, I actually do think things are changing. And I actually think I've been treated really well. Right. And you go back into his record and you're like, wait a minute, that doesn't quite match up to what we could see here. But the point being is he had grown up in a kind of different generation than all those other guys and had a different outlook. And so, you know, when you kind of talk to people who like are from that previous generation and they're all really jaded over something that happened to them. And then you talk to the other person who's just on the other side and they're like, I don't know why everyone's moaning. This is all great. That's how I felt talking to Maharaj. It was completely different than talking to any other South African spinner that I talked to of that probably 12 or 15.
Yeah. I mean, your experiences are what shape you. And Maharaj has a very interesting journey. And honestly, like, I didn't know much about this before I did my research. And I think I even messaged in our group that this could be a movie. And I can't believe how many cricketers I've used this phrase for. There's a Crick Pix in this at this point. We're probably going to even shoot it, you know, cricketers who could have a biopic on them. So here's where it starts. Not many people might know this, but Keshav's dad, Atmanand, was a former first-class cricketer for Natal B. And he wished for his son to achieve all that he couldn't, right? And there was also the fact that cricket in Atmanand's time was segregated and not in Keshav's, which only adds to the overall context, doesn't it?
Yeah, I didn't go back through his full record. I wanted to know if, I'm assuming the majority of first-class cricket he played would have been before. So when he was playing them, they might not have all been considered first-class games is the way, probably the correct way of putting them. And then after 1992, they start to go back and say, well, these leagues were actually really strong just because they weren't white people. These were considered first class. And it's not, no one thinks it's like a strong level of first class cricket because it wasn't. But it was good enough that they could consider it first class. Be interesting to see what period he comes from. But the overarching truth here is that there wasn't a lot of opportunities for a non-white player in the period in which he played. Yeah. And so when his son comes through, he obviously sees as a chance of them actually being able to do something with that. So I think it's a really interesting situation from that, which is, you know, there's an element of the father trying to push the son into this thing because he feels like he was aggrieved and he didn't get his chance. And so there's a kind of a twin driving sort of thing here, isn't there? They were both passionate about Keshav Maharaj making it.
That's where the movie would start, right? Atmanand's career and how it fails, and he pins all of his hopes on his son, which is a classic brown dad story as well. A lot of them will project their own, you know, dreams onto their children and hope that they can vicariously live through them when they are successful. So something similar was at play over here. But it must have helped, and of course, there's no confirmation that the story is true, but it must have helped that Indian wicketkeeper Kiran Moray supposedly looks at young Keshav's palms and he predicts that he'll grow up to become a cricketer. And, you know, palms and that sort of stuff are a little, I don't know, it depends on where you come from in the subcontinent, but some people take that stuff seriously, right? I don't know whether Atmanand did or not, but it must have motivated him or even, you know, encouraged him that, okay, maybe we're onto something. Maybe this two-year-old kid can actually become a cricketer someday.
If you are following my work, we know that you are a true cricket sadist and you need your hit
every day. And sometimes, sadly, there is actually no cricket to watch. So how about if someone made a very fun game that you could use for the moments when there is no on-field action? Welcome to Hit Wicket, a strategic game of cricket, which isn't about slamming your finger on the screen very fast. You work out what works best based on how cricket actually works. Dot balls lead to wickets, ones and twos to fours and sixes. So there is no way you can bowl a great Yorker every ball or smash three sixes at the beginning of your innings. This is proper cricket. Yet it still has some gaming powers in there as well. Hit Wicket is about playing, but also building and managing your team. You are the batter, bowler, owner, coach, and captain. It's your dream. No ads, just cricket. So download Hit Wicket today, because this is a cricket game made for you and supported by major cricket nerds.
So for me, I look at that story in a very different way, because obviously I don't believe in Palmer.
Yeah, of course, same.
You're going to be shocked to know I'd be on that. But I look at it in a different way and say, this is a kid very much brought up in a cricket community. Hmm. Do you know what I mean? So when it wasn't like, you know, we talked about his dad not quite making it or not pushing towards the top level. But what we do know is his dad was within a cricket culture, right? There were other players there. Around. And who knows, Kieran Moray might have said that to every second kid he ever met, right? But the point is that he did meet, and that Maharaj was brought up in a cricket fraternity. And, you know, look at Mitch Marsh and Sean Marsh and, you know, all these, you know, the Tremlets and all these different players who, you know, their dads are, you know, Stuart Broad or their uncles or, you know.
Johnny Bairstow.
Yeah, Alyssa Healy, all these sorts of people. It's a huge advantage when you do that. Like, you know, none of my three kids might end up being writers or podcasters or commentators, whatever, but there is actually a chance that they will, because they've got an expert in the house, and they're hanging out, you know, Ezekiel sees you hosting, right? Like he sees things, and he doesn't just see the on-air stuff, he sees all the off-air stuff, right?
Yeah.
Maharaj saw the same thing. Keshav, I should say. Keshav Maharaj saw all the same thing, right? He saw how the sausage was made. He saw what you had to do to be good at this, and he understood things. You know, I always look at Sofia Coppola and I think how incredible that must have been to have someone like Francis Ford Coppola just coming home and chucking scripts all the sorts of planning that goes behind a film that most people never ever see. And it's just on your kitchen table and your dad's going through it trying to work out, you know, how to end this scene in this movie. That sort of stuff is what you get. And so for me, the Kieran Moray story is about that. This is a guy who was born into cricket.
Mm, that's true. And I mean, of course, his dad has a major influence on him. Keshav is gifted his first English willow bat at age 5, right? And then it's also worth mentioning that Keshav Maharaj originally inspired to be a pace bowler. It was his dad, Atmanand, who helped convert him into a left-arm orthodox spinner. And, you know, you mentioned how Maharaj grew up in this cricketing culture, but it's not like he had a lot of help when it comes to spin bowling, right? He didn't have specialist coaches. He didn't have a Bernard Bosanquet to help him, for instance, like the four-leg spinners of the apocalypse did. And, you know, he was kind of on his own in that regard, even if he had the environment around him. When it came to his primary skill, he did not have, like, expertise available to him.
No, I think that's a really good point. And that's one of the things that I really... I wish now I'd known more about Maharaj's backstory when I interviewed him. And it was only a short interview and he didn't want to be there. I'm not having a go. Like, it was the end of a training session. He was tired. He gave me 15, 20 minutes. He answered all my questions. But like, I could tell when someone wants to be there when they don't. And he didn't engage in the interview all that much. I wish I'd known about this, because this is the one thing that I remember, you know, Robin Peterson and Paul Adams and some of the other, you know, spinners I talked to, they were like, the issue sometimes isn't that you are not used in teams, and it isn't that you have to bowl defensively. Sometimes the issue is that there isn't anyone there whose speciality is to help you.
Yeah.
Right? And Paul Harris, I think, as I said, at that point was becoming a coach, and I'm not sure if he still does a lot of coaching over there, but he was saying that he felt it was almost important that that the former spinners became coaches. And I know Robin Peterson is obviously a coach, and Paul Adams was a coach briefly. I'm not sure what he's doing at the moment, but I know he was coaching. And so you suddenly have this whole situation, right, where they can't produce spinners naturally because of the pitches and because of the outlook. And then when they do produce spinners, they can't make them good because there isn't anyone there. And it's one of these things. I remember when, I think it was when Moeen Ali was with England and he was touring and he was clearly like at the beginning, you know, he didn't know what he was doing. Mm-hmm. And Alistair Cook, like England had a really good batting coach. I can't remember who it was, maybe Ram Prakash or whoever was their batting coach, right? Alistair Cook had someone he could turn to and Moeen Ali didn't have a spin bowling coach,
yeah,
right? So there is an element of that in the Western cricket culture, the non-Asian cricket culture, right? Where like we haven't even put two and two together that it's like, if there's three or four fast bowlers, they can all work together. If there's one spinner, and let's say you're on a tour, you've got one senior spinner and one junior spinner, like that, there's a lot of pressure on that senior spinner to take all the wickets and also look after the junior spinner. And you look back at South Africa and you're like, well, how are you going to produce spinners if you weren't actually getting coaches to come in and help produce them?
Yeah, I mean, at least with England, you saw how they hired Mushtaq and Saqlain.
That was later on. Yeah,
later on, but at least they made that effort. You don't really see that in South Africa ever.
Well, and but also, that's too late.
Yeah.
If you've already picked a guy for Test cricket, like I'm not saying they wouldn't help. You should definitely have those people there, right? But realistically, the big issue is who is coaching Maharaj at 16? Who's coaching him at 20 and 21? And when you go back and you talk to these old South African spinners, they're like, no one, I had to work it out on my own.
Yeah. So coming back to his story, of course, he did go on to debut for the Dolphins at age 16. But there was a major hurdle in his journey. You know, Keshav was overweight and overweight by quite a lot. And, you know, he even felt that that was the basis on which he missed out or failed to get selected for the South Africa under-19 team. So he was well aware of that. And as per his own admission, he could destroy a loaf of bread and a 2-liter Coke in a single sitting, which is a lot. The other player that
also,
I can think of.
Also, just like a horrendous meal. I mean, I say that as a kid. When I was a kid, I probably could have done the same. But what a horrendous meal to, like, thinking back on it. It's like, that's what you've chosen to stuff your gullet with?
Absolutely. Those two things don't even go together. If it was pizza and a 2-liter Coke, I would be like,
now
okay.
You're talking my language,
I can understand that. But it's interesting. Mahesh Teekshana is another spinner who was very overweight and he kind of cut down. But, you know, from the what I'm reading is that Keshav was, not only was he overweight, he had a problem to give up, you know, or stop his poor eating habits. Like, he just could not, you know, say no to his favorite foods. He had to eat them. It was something he had no control over and something that even if he knew was a problem, he wasn't really willing to change.
Yeah, I think for me, I try not to go into the weight side of things all that much, right? Because we have had great cricketers who have, you know, non-traditional athletic bodies. And as we're getting into T20 cricket, I think we're going to see more, you know, sort of, I know, Richard Levi and Rakeem Cornwall and Lizelle Lee type bodies. And we actually need to...
Jesse Ryder.
I think we actually need to understand that these bodies actually can be an advantage in cricket in some ways, right? My issue was that I don't care whether you're overweight or underweight. Like, there's no professional athlete should be drinking 2 liters. I can only imagine how much sugar is in 2 liters. It must be like 40 spoons of sugar, right?
Has to be.
No professional something athlete like needs 40 spoons of sugar. Like, people get really upset and if you say that you should cut sugar out of your diet. Like, I don't want to get here and become a dietary king, right? Although I am someone who lost 50 kilos, so I have learned a fair bit about, you know, losing weight and food over the time. But the point being is I don't care about that. No one needs to put 40 sugar, spoonfuls of sugar into your body in that sort of way. So that's step one of what he was doing wrong. But my point would be is that he wasn't professional. It's not what a professional would do because a professional is, you know, is looking after your body. So Tahrir Shamsi had an issue with his weight. He then lost a bunch of weight and felt like he wasn't bowling the same way, right? And he went back to his old bowling weight. That to me suggests that he had the ability as a professional to change what he was doing, didn't feel comfortable when he had changed and went back to the old way of doing things. Keshav Maharaj, I don't care if he's 120 kilos or 70 kilos, right? What I care about is he making professional decisions? And no one who is having a 2-liter bottle of Coke and a whole lot of white bread is making professional decisions. And I think that is a really important one. And if you go through spinners are athletic in a different way. Like, I've told this story before, but, you know, I can swim faster than R. Ashwin, right? I've raced him in a pool. He doesn't. One day someone's going to tell him this. He's not going to remember it. But like one day I'm going to meet him, and the first thing he's going to say to me, "Tell me about this thing in the pool." Like, he's not going to remember it. But I was overweight when I was that. But I was in. I was a better swimmer than him, and I was probably still had more, you know, fast twitch muscle fiber, whatever you need to be a good freestyle swimmer and all that sort of stuff, right? So, but he's an incredible athlete in other ways, right? And how professional is R. Ashwin in other parts of his career, the way that he thinks about stuff, right? And you look at someone like Phil Tufnell, who couldn't hold a bat, right? And couldn't field at all. But when you talk to Phil Tufnell about bowling, you can see there was a lot there. He had other issues with drink and all sorts of things, mental health and everything else, right? So we have lots of spinners with those sorts of non-traditional bodies. But if you are trying to make your career specifically in South Africa, where I would say it is a culture that does talk a lot about bodies in general, especially within cricket, there are some cricket cultures where your fitness isn't brought up all that much. And there are some cricket cultures where no one ever shuts up about it. And I would say South Africa is at the top of one of those lists. Yeah. That would have caused him issues and did cause him issues. And Lance Klusener, who was his coach at the time, said, go to England and lose 5 kilos when he went to play club cricket. But for me, if I was working with him, I would never have said, go to England and lose 5 kilos. What I would have said is, start to think like a professional. And that involves your fitness. It involves your mentality. It involves, don't just go to the nets and bowl. Think about why you're going to the nets to bowl that day and all those decisions, and make every decision you make from here on in about being a professional cricketer.
So that's an interesting one, right? Because obviously his eating habits are all over the place. He knows this. He doesn't want to change it. Supposedly has no control over it and just cannot say no to his favorite foods. But when it comes to his discipline, as far as training and going to the nets is concerned, I mean, his work ethic was on point over there. He would not miss a net session. He would always turn up, you know, first person to training, last one to leave. He had that work ethic going for him. So it's quite a interesting contrast, you would have to say, right?
No, definitely. And I think when you see a player like that, and look, you know, I'm on the lookout for young writing talent and producing talent and podcast talent all the time. I'm not always looking for a person who's already, I don't already want the next Harsha Bogle, right? I'm looking for someone who has the habits, who is going to come back every single day and do the thing, who's going to be professional, who's going to think about that. And I think if you're looking at it from a Lance Klusener point of view, and you're thinking, well, this guy isn't an athlete, and he isn't training like an athlete, and he isn't eating like an athlete, but he is thinking about how to improve himself every day. All he needs to do is work out that improving yourself every day is not just about where you land the ball.
Yeah.
It's everything around that. That's a really good habit to get into. So the fact that he had that was probably a huge advantage to him, right? And on top of the fact that he was a naturally gifted spinner, that's the sort of thing you can work with. It's the old one. What's the one in baseball of you've got two players who can run to first base, and one does it with a perfect technique and gets in at, you know, 10.8. I don't know why I said 10.8. I don't know how long it takes you to run to a base in baseball. But the other guy runs in at 10.85 and has an absolutely horrendous technique and is all over the shop. You generally go with the 10.8 guy because you can work back from that, right? And I think having the skills that Maharaj had is certainly an element of that.
Yeah, I mean, as far as, you know, his routine was concerned when he was playing cricket or bowling, you know, overs and overs of spin, that part was sorted. It's just that everything around it was just, you know, not up to scratch. And you know, in sport, I think in all of sport mostly, when you're overweight, people definitely notice it. They notice it more than, you know, any normal average Joe living their own life. And then you are judged for this, right? Azam Khan is a good example of this, right? In Pakistan, he is literally mutilated by the media for being overweight. And while there is some merit to that argument, people also take it overboard. Weirdly enough, you know, in Maharaj's circle, there was no one who ever confronted him about this. And it's not like he wasn't conscious either. He wouldn't change in the locker room in front of his teammates. He would go to the bathroom to change. So clearly, you know, he was well aware that, you know, he was body conscious and not particularly confident. And again, as you mentioned, this is a sporting culture, you know, South Africa, where these things are more pronounced than any other sporting culture. So that must have been a very interesting place to be in.
Yeah, I find it really interesting no one confronted him on it, actually, only because, you know, I remember Mitch Marsh was a player that I remember people talking about a lot, right? And Mitch Marsh wasn't particularly big, but he did blow up a little bit when he stopped playing Aussie rules football. And obviously he's a freakish athlete in a way that probably Maharaj isn't, right?
To be fair, Jared, had I not known this story, when you look at Keshav Maharaj, you could never guess that this guy was overrated. The man is a twig.
No, but even now, I think we'd say he's a good moving athlete. But he's not Mitch Marsh, right? Like like Mitch Marsh had two different sports courting him, and probably, you know, if he had a good jump shot, could have been a basketballer as well, or, you know, and his mum was a netballer. I think his sister was a basketballer or something like that. Like, the whole family are freak athletes, quite clearly, in the Marsh family. Maharaj isn't like that. Like, his athletic skills are soft skills, right? You know, hands and everything else. But you're right. I mean, you know, you listen to the story and you do realize that Maharaj has made himself into what he is. But the point being is that I just remember Mitch Marsh always being told that. So I found that another really interesting part of it. And again, I wonder if he's a fast bowler, if that's different. Because if he's a spinner, they're just like, you know, he's just a spinner. Eventually, you know, he's going to have to work this out or we'll find someone else. And if he's a fast bowler, they're just like, mate, you got to run this off because you're really important to us. So I wonder if there's an element of that to it. But yeah, no, you're right. I think it's quite interesting the way that it happened. But also the fact he wouldn't change in front of his teammates and stuff. I can't think of many times I've ever heard any players talk about that sort of stuff. I think that's a really honest and incredible thing for Maharaj to admit.
This is brought to you by Cricket 8. They are a new player in the game trying to educate fans on what is really happening in cricket. We have a partnership with them where we host live watch-alongs, do podcasts and write articles. If you want to know what is really happening with our game, visit cricket8.com.
Yeah, and I think it's a very brave thing to admit as well. And obviously, you know, you're not as confident a bloke in general in the dressing room if you're going through those sorts of things. And people probably aren't confronting you about it, but they would have the look in their eye that, oh, here's that overweight guy again. And, you know, he's bringing us down or whatever. All sorts of crap happens in teams, right? And here's the fun part of the story. By age 22, Maharaj, who has failed multiple yo-yo tests on the regular by this point, you know, he is in a place where his coach at the Dolphins, Lance Klusder, he mentions how, you know, at that point, Maharaj could not run, field, or catch. So apart from spinning the ball, he's not adding any utility. The value add is low. And people also had reservations around how long he could bowl for. So how long will the spells be? So this was a point where Maharaj was actually ready to explore different options, perhaps call it quits with respect to his cricketing career. And that's where his father comes in again. So great scene in the movie, right? The father is older now. He's coming in and he convinces Maharaj to give cricket one more year in his life. And this is where everything changes, kind of. Beyond this moment, it's kind of all uphill.
Yeah, and I think it's a really important relationship. And, you know, I feel, and it'd be great to interview the both of them separately and together, and, you know, do a proper story with them. But I wonder if Maharaj wasn't someone who was naturally good at cricket, thought cricket was really cool, loved playing the game, but didn't have the fire to become the professional that he needed to.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people who play cricket, and I'm not going to name any names, but I know them. And they're just guys who happen to be good at cricket, who play cricket and have a skill, right? There's a big difference between them and the guys that do absolutely everything to maximize every part of their talent, right? There's a lot of guys out there that are around Faf du Plessis' level of talent, right?
Yeah.
They don't maximize every inch of it the way that Faf ended up doing, right? And so I think in that sort of case, the fact that his father was saying, like, give it one more year. I think his father probably realized that he was on the wane and it wasn't fun anymore. And when it's not fun, why am I still sticking around with it, right? Like, why am I still involved with it? So I think that's a really, really fascinating way of looking at things overall of, you know, he got to a point where where he got to a point where he had to be pushed into it. And we see this a lot with sons of professional athletes, right? Like the father can see that the top end, that the ability is really high, but then the drive isn't there. And in this case, you know, giving that one extra year is probably what he needed. And then the other side of it is sometimes just when you're already resigned to the fact it's not going to work, all the pressure comes off you and you can relax.
Yeah. I mean, Keshav, in hindsight, would be really grateful to his father that he convinced him to, you know, carry on for one more year, because now he's South Africa's highest ever wicket taker for spin bowling in Test cricket. And here's what happens thereon. Like a year later, Cuckfield Cricket Club in the UK signed Maharaj as their overseas player. That's the point where Klusner tells him to go and lose 5 kilos. But, you know, he does far more than that. It triggers Maharaj to change his diet. He takes up running as well. He's also the groundsman at Cuckfield, and he would run 4 kilometers to and from his lodging to the ground, trying to beat his best time daily, right? He has the high score mentality as well. And rather than 5 kilos, he ends up losing 17.5 kg, which in many ways is the watershed moment in his career, even more than his test debut, I believe, because that is ridiculous. Like 17.5 kilos in a single summer, that's got to take a lot of effort.
I think what happens is, and I know Shane Warne didn't lose the weight, but Shane Warne went to England as well. And you've got to understand what being a professional cricketer in England is like. You are playing with guys who are not in shape at all. Mm-hmm. You're playing, you know, club cricket in England is not particularly strong. Like, it's not like a brutal competition. It's not like, you know, Chennai or Mumbai or Sydney or Melbourne, right? Like, it's not that kind of like top level cricket. And so you are expected to make all the runs, to take all the wickets, to mow the grass, to coach all the kids. It's a really, like, I watch these guys sometimes and I was like, I always wondered when I was younger why people didn't come out year after year and do it. Because I was like, for me, I would have loved the opportunity to go to England and play cricket in England, right? I would have been up for it. But like, I've got friends who did it and they were like, look, it was great, but geez, like it was one of the greatest times of my life. But none of them are queuing up to go back, right? And I know people who won't go back and do it.
And also there's an element of getting shit-faced after every game. From what I've
heard.
Well,
in some, and if you're not from a drinking culture, you're suddenly in a drinking culture. If you're not from a, you know, like English cricket clubs can be quite, you know, certainly in the South can be quite elite. If you don't come from, you know, there's all these weird elements to it. A lot of people will tell you it's the best time of their life, but they'll also say it was a full on 6 or 7 months. But the real one is, and you know this story, but Franklin Stevenson essentially invents the slower ball. Right.
Yeah.
Because he's playing, I can't remember, he might have even been in county cricket at this time, but it's the same thing of like they were bowling him so much that he couldn't keep bowling seam. And so he starts to bowl spin. And bowling spin, he's like, wait a minute, if I just bowl this ball when I'm bowling seam, this will be a really good delivery to be able to bowl. That just comes from they were overworking Franklin Stevenson. And that is what happened to Keshav Maharaj and happens to a lot of young pros in English cricket. And you also, if you do want to come back the next year, you need to have like ridiculous numbers because there are like some of the players. Remember, there was one year Stuart Binney was playing in the IPL, finished the IPL and came and played at the local cricket club here. I was like, my God, like the quality of cricketers that are coming over and getting contracts to play is ridiculous, right?
Yeah.
Half the Scottish team play in the local league around me at one point, right? Like, and there's a lot of money involved and they play, but you have to perform. He was in a professional cricket environment, right? But he was in a professional cricket environment where he was good enough to get a contract and to stick around.
Yeah.
That's very different than playing for your supper every week, right?
Very true.
And it's that level of professionalism, you know, completely, I think, changed things quite a bit for him. And he went to the level of pushing through. So he's not the only professional. He talked to lots of people. I mean, it's not just England as well. You know, we've heard stories of people going over and playing club cricket in South Africa and playing club cricket in Australia. Sometimes it's just the change of culture, right? And you don't have your friends to hang out with and you don't have your normal habits. And, you know, you've got to professionalize because you've got to I've got to be coaching at this time. I've got to be cutting the grass at this time.
Honestly, Jared, you probably don't have the money to cab it daily to and from your lodging to the ground. So that's why you're running it and you're like, oh, this helps my fitness as well. You end up losing 17.5 kilos. And also, he had a mighty successful season at Cuckfield. In 14 league games, he took 45 wickets at 15.6 apiece. He also improved his fielding and batting. And he became vocal in the dressing room. You know, his experience in the dressing room was not even staying in the locker room for, you know, changing clothes. He was going to the bathroom. And all of a sudden, he is this presence in that dressing room and comes back to South Africa a completely new cricketer.
And he came back a professional.
Yeah.
Right? And again, if you're an overseas pro, you are expected to talk in the change room, right? You are. There are lots of different elements of this that he just had to do. It's a story that we've heard a lot in cricket. The 17 kilos is the big killer different one there. I mean, that's a lot of weight to lose in a small period of time.
How quickly did you lose the 50 kilos?
So I didn't lose the 50 kilos in 6 months, but you can, I always felt losing the first 10 or 15 kilos for me was the easiest, right? Once I changed my dietary habits and started exercising, like the first, I don't know how much it would have been for me, but the first 15 kilos maybe came right off. The next bit is when occasionally the bits that most people struggle with are when you plateau. When everything you did doesn't seem to work and you have a couple of months or, even a year where it doesn't go that much. But then you get past that and you up your exercise or you keep tweaking your diet and what you're eating and how you're processing, you go down. But everything after that is a slog, right? Mm. And what could have happened for him, which is also what I've heard of happening before, is you go on tour, you travel and you eat. Your normal foods aren't available to you anyway. So you eat differently, you lose weight, but then you come back home and you go back to your bad foods.
Well, most I'm of sure my there were loaves of bread and 2 liter Cokes available in England. So
there were, but what I mean is that I'm assuming that was only part of his dietary issues.
Yeah.
Right? Mm. And maybe the Coke tasted slightly different to him in England, right? Mm. Or whatever that may be. But then going back of like, I always remember when I would go back to Australia, that was my big challenge because all my bad eating habits are Australian, right? So it's a very different situation. So I think that's why I say it's not just I don't think it was about, diet or losing weight for him. I really think it was about professionalism. By the time he got back to, I was going to say Australia then, by the time he got back to South Africa, I think he was just a different person, right? And so he left as an amateur cricketer who was having a fun little experiment, playing a little bit of cricket when he was young. Mm. And when he comes back in, he's a professional cricketer who's completely changed.
And that professionalism kind of carries through in the years that, all the subsequent seasons that he's playing in South Africa, he has improved stats, like 36 wickets each in the next two seasons at averages of 29.38 and 32, respectively. Then at the start of the third season, he takes 13 for 157 in the first match of the season. And that is an effort that earns him a call-up to South Africa's test squad, who are set to tour Australia. And his first ever test wicket is Steve Smith, arguably the best test batter in the world at that time. Keshav Maharaj had arrived.
Yeah, and I think it all happened fast when you consider his overall professional career because he was in the system, but he was in the system for a long time. So it's kind of one of those overnight success stories that isn't really an overnight success story at all, right? Like he actually had to earn it for a long period of time. And, coming to Australia, he wasn't expecting to play in that test match. Was it Dale Steyn who was injured, I think, for that test? So. They went with an extra spinner. So let's think back to that. I probably covered that match, or I don't think I was in Australia for that series, but I would have been watching that match, whatever. It's a South African spinner, right? Well, no one's getting excited. No one's talking him up. He bowled fine. He got smacked at the start, and then he fought back on the second day. But yeah, there's no reason for us to really over-egg it or anything else. It's like,
South Africans are never excited either. It's not like it's the rest of the world who aren't taking him seriously. I bet like South Africa's also like, oh yeah, that's another spinner. It's like the dressing next to this, or not even the dressing. It's like a cucumber in the salad, right?
Yeah.
Like it's not adding any calories. It's barely adding any flavor. But then again, he goes on to remove Steve Smith as his first wicket, which is huge. And I also found it a bit iconic that he gets his test cap from Hashim Amla, another South African cricketer of South Asian descent.
Yep.
So that must have been really special for him.
This is brought to you by HitWicket, the cricket game that has playing and strategy all in your pocket.
No, I agree. I think it is a really interesting one. And again, we look back at this and we kind of think about it. But at the time, this was just a non-story, right? Like the idea that he would beat Tayfield's record was ridiculous. The idea that, I mean, we hope he becomes the first South African bowler to take 200 test wickets. He might be the first South African bowler to take 250 wickets. Mm-hmm. He might be the first South African bowler to take 300 wickets.
Yeah.
And no one saw that coming outside of, and I would almost put Keshav in that and Lance Klusner in that. Like his dad is the only one who, and Kieran Moray. His dad and Kieran Moray are the only two that saw that coming, right?
Yeah. I mean, some bloke at Cuckfield as well, given that they would have looked at that transformation live and would have been inspirational.
These Cuckfield teammates are the only other ones who'd be like, wow.
Yeah. All those inspirational speeches in the dressing room, which we don't know happened or not, but we know that he was vocal. Complete tangent, but if we were to make this movie, there are two soundtracks that we need to come up with. One when he's running to and from his ground in Cuckfield, and then the whole montage of the few domestic seasons between Cuckfield and his test debut. Those two songs are very, very important for this movie. And we can't go with Eye of the Tiger.
I'll talk to Sofia Coppola when we're working on this film together.
Yeah. You mentioned Tayfield and how, of course, Maharaj overtook him. Tayfield had 170 wickets and Maharaj now has 171. But there is one interesting difference over here. Despite Maharaj's 171 wickets and all the success that he's had, he hasn't really bowled an awful lot in Test cricket. Like out of 87 innings in the longest format, he hasn't bowled at all in 10 of them. And in 25 of them, he's bowled less than 10 overs. Now compare that to Hugh Tayfield, who was considered or still is considered one of the most effective spinners in the history of Test cricket and also hails from South Africa. He like bowls so much in his time that it isn't really a comparison at all. On average, he used to bowl 6 ball overs in a game. And he averaged under 26 all the while, you know. So 26 runs per dismissal still are fantastic numbers for any spinner in Test cricket. Mm. And he also had an economy of basically nothing. So you'd still have to say that Tayfield was the better spinner. But in a way, Maharaj, you know, can get the best out of himself because the workloads aren't as high. Is there a correlation there?
Yeah, I suppose it means that Maharaj probably was slower to develop at times because Tayfield would have had to bowl everywhere. I mean, Tayfield never had to bowl in Asia. So it's worth remembering that all those tellies come without him ever bowling in Asia, which means he didn't have to go against the best players of spin, but also didn't get to bowl with the best conditions.
True.
So it's interesting. And they would essentially put Tayfield on in the same way they used Harris, really.
Yeah.
They will put Tayfield on at one end and just be like, lock this end up and we will rotate the seamers from the other end, right? And you said his economy was basically nothing. Just so people know what basically nothing is, 1.94 is his bowling
so
economy.
So he's Lance Gibbsing it in a way.
Yeah, I think he was. That period of cricket had a few of those kinds of bowlers, very defensive finger spinners who would bowl over and over again. Not that they weren't skillful, because both of those bowlers, one would go on to take 300 wickets and the other one had a bowling average of 26. They're both great bowlers, but that was their job, was literally to lock up an end. Hmm. And few people did it ever better than Tayfield. That isn't Maharaj's job all that often. Like, he occasionally will come on to do that, right? He will occasionally come on to rest the seamers and everything else. But it's quite often brought on when there is an advantage, whether it be a matchup or the pitch or anything like that. And he's not used as just that basic South African stock bowler that we are used to, that sort of, Robin Peterson and Paul Harris sort of role of just bowl defensively, don't go for many runs and keep the pressure on and we'll get the wickets from the other end. Maharaj is used in a way of, let's get wickets. And I think that's evolved over time. But the minute it looks like Maharaj is not needed, like It'd be really interesting to go through. I would say that the vast majority of times that Nathan Lyon hasn't bowled would be that they just took wickets too quickly to get him into the attack. There'd be a couple of those Maharaj, but even when the wicket is really, really seeming, Australia, even when Nathan Lyon, before he became, you know, the bowler he was, they would give him a bowl just to see if there was also something for the spinners.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that Maharaj has always had that kind of treatment. But as he goes on, I think now, there was times in the T20 World Cup. I know it's a different format, but times in the T20 World Cup where I actually thought they used him too much and they should have had more seamers on, especially in places like America and everything. It's like, why are you bowling a left arm finger spinner now? Just bowl your one of your quicks and whack it into the pitch and you'll get wickets here. And I think that shows how much they've changed about him.
You also have to take into consideration that he's really upped his game, considering that initially he was just a test match spinner and now he's an all-format spinner. He's crucial to the ODI team and he's now started to play very, very regularly for the T20 team as well. Captains aside in the SA20, he made it to the final as well and he's got IPL contracts. Like, his stature as a overall spinner in the world of cricket has really shot up in the last 3 years or so.
Definitely. I remember about 3 years ago, you know, saying how good Maharaj was and like the comments on YouTube were brutal, right? People are just like, what are you talking about? Like, very bog ordinary spinner. I don't think anyone carries that anymore right now. I think everyone thinks this is a really good cricketer. You know, I like to make fun of his batting because, you know, he can hold a bat, but he's not a batter. And people get really upset. Like, what are you talking about? He's almost an all-rounder. I'm like, he's not almost an all-rounder. Fuck's sake. He's not shit with the bat, but he's not almost an all-rounder. But he won that game against Pakistan, was it?
It was Pakistan.
And he's played a couple of other really important innings. He's actually played some good knocks in losing matches as well at times over that period. He's just continually getting better. So, yeah, I'm 100% with you. I think, you know, the fact that he basically outgrew the normal South African spinner's role.
Yeah.
And then he overcame Tabriz Shamsi, who was a really good limited over spinner. And then he got to the point where I think it would be weird now if he was dropped.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas traditionally, it didn't really matter how good you were as a South African spinner. There were sometimes you were just going to be dropped. Whereas now, I think if you dropped him, it would be a bit like dropping Nathan Lyon, right? Or Dan Vettori. I suppose it'd be different because Vettori could bat, but it'd be a bit like dropping, you know, Nathan Lyon, where you'd say, yeah, we get it. It's going to seem, but like, or Graham Swan, those kinds of players. We like, but there's really no point of dropping them. They're still going to be good bowlers on these surfaces. And that's the difference, I think, from being that sort of a really good version of the traditional South African bowler and being just a bowler that you pick automatically because of how good he is.
I mean, he's got great control. You can play him on any surface. And he generally is a very reliable sort of cricketer to have, right? You can expect, you know, dependability from Keshav Maharaj. And he's never going to kind of lose you a game like that. He's going to consistently give you, you know, good dividends. And that's why he's become such a prime commodity to the point that he's getting IPL gigs. Even if he doesn't get all those games in the season, he'll play 4 or 5 and he'll play them well. Like, we saw that in this IPL as well.
Let's be honest, a pure South African spinner who's not a mystery spinner.
Yes.
Getting picked in the IPL.
Who does his basics correctly.
Who can't bat, really. Like, you're not picking him for his batting. And is a fielder. I don't think he's a bad fielder, but he's not like, it's not fucking Jonty Rhodes, is he? Do you know what I mean? Like, he's not.
He's not Mahesh Teekshan either. So he's somewhere in between.
Yeah, but what I mean is, he's like Nathan Lyon. He's a good fielder, but he's not a game-changing fielder. Right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, so you're not picking him because of his batting or his fielding at all. He is legitimately in the side for his bowling. That's huge, isn't it? Absolutely huge that a South African spinner can get in. And the fact that they've had two of them, I think is a really interesting story as well. And I don't think it's an accident that we see both of them in this modern era.
Yeah, Tabriz Shamsi at least can turn the ball both directions, but Maharaj
there is an element of mystery to him, right? Like, there's an element of, he's not a mystery bowler, but left arm wrist spinners are almost mystery spinners anyway because there's so few of them. So there's an element of that. There's no element of that to Maharaj. Like, we all know basically what he's going to do each ball, right?
Yep.
And that, you know, and there are a lot of left arm finger spinners in India, right? Mm. So he's fighting all the domestic finger spinners and he's still there. I think that's an incredible story.
Yeah, yeah, it is immense, actually. I actually want to talk to you about his captain and how much of a role he would have played, in your opinion, you know, in Maharaj's success. And that captain is Faf du Plessis. He was his captain in the first test match that Maharaj played. And then for a while, till, you know, things got ugly between Faf and Cricket South Africa. But basically, Faf had played in the IPL, in the Chennai Super Kings, and learned a thing or two from his captain over there, MS Dhoni, on how to use spinners better. How much did Maharaj benefit from that?
Oh, every single modern spinner I talked to said the same thing, that essentially up until Faf, captaining spinners in South Africa was almost always terrible. Hmm. And they weren't just talking about the international level, they were talking all the way through. You know, you look at the way that Graham Smith handled Paul Harrison around here. Yeah. Graham Smith didn't want spin. He didn't care about spin. It wasn't anything to... He just had to pick them because the fast bowlers eventually had to be rested, right?
He probably thought that he was just as good a spinner himself than the rest of the guys.
I'm sure that's right, actually. And so to go from that, and I know there are other captains in between, but essentially to go from Graham Smith's opinion to Faf du Plessis, who probably came up, was brought up with a similar thought, right? And then he gets to Chennai in, I don't know when it was, 2010, 2011. And suddenly he's like told, this is how you handle spin, or shown, I should say, how you handle spin. The South Africans just said it was a whole new world. They just, they are, all of them, even the guys who were former players, were saying you could see it on the pitch. The way that they were using spin was understanding of how spinners need to be treated. And they are a different kind of bowler. Like, the idea that you would treat them like a fast bowler doesn't make any sense. It's a completely different kind of art. You know, I still see it in England. I was playing in a game recently with a short boundary and a young leg spinner bowling, and they didn't put out, our team didn't put out a deep mid wicket. And I said to the captain, you need a deep mid wicket. And he goes, we're not setting fields for bad bowling. I was like, A, people hit the mid wicket whether the ball's good or bad, especially in club cricket. B, yeah. Adil Rashid has a deep point in a test match when he comes onto ball. So you're saying that Adil Rashid can get protection, and that your 16-year-old Canadian leg spinner, right, or American leg spinner, wherever this kid was from, doesn't need protection? What are we talking about here? And in South Africa, I think that was a big part of it, right? Of like, yeah. You know, you should just do what we tell you to do, get the ball in the right area, put a little bit of revs on it, and don't cause any trouble for us. Yeah. Faf comes in, sees MS Dhoni working with him, changes his mind on spin, and he starts to do it. Now, what I heard was it filtered down to the lower levels, but there were still some issues at the lower levels where there were a lot of captains who didn't give a shit. But they started to see that there was a way forward when it came to spinners and the way to treat them. And I think that is an incredibly important thing. And it would have been really interesting if Maharaj had started 2 years earlier, where his career would be now. Like, if that year when he plays first class cricket and takes 30 odd wickets, if that's the year he takes 50 and gets picked, I don't know if he has the same career.
And maybe because he had Faf as his captain, who kind of, you know, had studied MS Dhoni and was using spinners better, is the reason why when you spoke to Maharaj, he was quite happy with the way he was treated. Like, it was different from every other spinner that you talked to. Maybe Faf had a big role to play over there. But another element worth discussing here, Jared, is how, and this came up in the hybrid pitches footmarks as well, is how South African wickets have changed over time. And potentially that is because of global warming. The tracks tend to turn a lot more now than ever before. And you've got to say that Maharaj has been, you know, very, very fortunate in that regard in his career, because it's coincided with this period perfectly.
Yeah. I should say that the global warming theory is the South African cricket theory. Like, I don't think scientists have gone and tested it or anything like that. But yes, that's what they say. They're really clear about it. They're like, no. These wickets have changed. The pitches spin a lot more here. It's hotter in South Africa now. They get crustier. And so, again, those are two big advantages. If the surfaces actually help you more and your captain understands what to do, that's a huge thing. And Maharaj... sometimes, as you said before, was it your experiences define you? Like, those are his experiences. South African wickets aren't that hard to bowl. And what are all the old guys complaining about? Yeah. And I get good treatment from my captain. What's this nonsense about, right? But we know
I challenge
that
you to score runs against me on day 5 in Durban.
Yeah. Whereas, but in the old days, the truth is, neither of those things were that common. South African wickets were, you know, probably helped a bowler like Warne, maybe.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't know if we go back to like before the last 10 years, I don't remember, you know, really good overseas bowlers going there and doing much. Do you? Yeah. Like, it wasn't a Ajmal. Thing that we have.
Only Ajmal did well in recent.
But when was Ajmal?
2013, I would say.
See, I reckon that's when it starts to change.
Ah.
Right? So I think it's around that. Well, it depends on who you talk to. I've heard anywhere from 2010 to 2014 is when the wickets are noticeably different for spinners in South Africa. And I do think that there is an element of that again. And, you know, I don't think there is probably a lot of success before that. But, you know, the truth is that it wasn't easy.
Since then, you've got what, Ravindra Jadeja, he got like 7 once, you know, in an innings or something.
I quite a few spinners. Yeah. So if you go
Embul Denia took a fifer.
Yep. So Warne took 61 wickets at 24. And then you had Kumble averaged 32 there. So I think, again, you've got wrist spinners getting a little bit out of it. Clary Grimmett took a lot of wickets, but that was against a pretty poor South African team. And there isn't really that many others. So, you know, Murali was okay there. So there is an element of, it wasn't a dead place for spin in the way that, say, New Zealand is, right? Yeah. But it also wasn't a place that teams thought that they needed their spinners. And some of these good records, it's worth saying that South Africa is a really interesting one because I've looked at this before. When you look at South Africa and spin, it's actually not that the spinners always did bad. It's that the seamers did so much better.
Yeah.
And so it becomes tough for you to actually pick your seamers because of that. And, you know, so Harmer's played, what, 4 tests and has a bowling average of 18 in South Africa over the last couple of years, right? You saw Harbhajan Singh in 2010 and 11. He has a good series. Right.
Also, Jadeja did not take 7. He took 6. 6 for 138, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was
so had what he had about. An average in the low 30s and everything else. Dom Best took wickets in a game, if I'm not mistaken, as well. So, you know, there's a few different spinners that have gone through. And as you said, Embul Denia is another one. And I think Hafiz might have taken some wickets there as well. I'm just trying to go through the list really quickly. It just feels like now that if you go to South Africa, you think you won't need a spinner, right? Yeah. And I was saying before you would take your spinners because you had them, whereas I think now you think to yourself, no, there might be a pitch or there might be a time in the game when we actually need them. I think that has changed quite a lot.
Yeah, and Maharaj is the perfect spinner to have if you're, you know, South African because he's a seasoned professional by this point. He knows exactly what he's doing and he's gotten the best out of those surfaces. Like, it's kind of a match made in heaven in that regard that he comes into cricket at this perfect time where Faf is captain, the surfaces are changing, and all of a sudden, now he's taken 171 test wickets, already the most ever for a South African spinner in the format. And that too in less than 8 years since making his debut. I think that is also very key over here that, you know, he's kind of raced to 171 wickets considering that South Africa don't even play an awful lot of tests. So, at the age of 34 currently, he is undoubtedly South Africa's best test spinner since readmission. I think we can make that claim comfortably.
Yeah.
And earlier in the podcast, you were like, maybe he becomes the first to 200, first to 250, first to 300. But realistically, given that he's 34, how many wickets do you think he'll end up with in test cricket?
Well, considering his athleticism and his professionalism today, I just, unless his finger, his wrist or his elbow go, or shoulder, you know, whatever one of those key finger spinning things go, I can't see any reason why he can't play to 37, 38. Now, how many tests South Africa plays and how many times he plays in them, considering that he doesn't always get picked in the team anymore because they don't always pick their best team. There's obviously my guess is even if he doesn't play in the IPL, he'll probably be on the bench for a lot of IPL teams because of the experience and the knowledge that he has.
Yep.
Like he's a good person to have around, I would think. Mm-hmm.
He's a good leader at this point, right?
Like, well, that's what I mean.
He's got like, that energy.
I think, you know, he's a better bowler than Ish Sodhi, but a little bit like Ish Sodhi, the right kind of person to have on the bench, you know, to have one voice who's, you know, not an Indian there, but actually understands the art form at the same point. So I think he might not play that. I think 250 is within his range though. Mm. I, I think 300 is a long way away. It, also, he doesn't take a lot of wickets per test because they usually, the seam bowls are still going to take a lot more in their conditions. So I think there's a few things that play against him. But I think if you told me he played for another 4 years, I would say, well, then he should be at 250 minimum at that point. Yeah. I know it's a long way away. It's still 80. That's 80 wickets away. But I would assume 20 wickets a year should not be beyond him, right? Like,
I mean,
even everything I've just said, still, that's not a lot of wickets. That's like three or four. Well, that's like four good games, right?
Yeah. I mean, if his fitness holds up and he plays another 30 test matches, right? Maybe I'm being a bit generous over here, but I see a best case scenario in which he gets another 100 test wickets easy. But of course, there is a worst case scenario, and in that he maybe just quits after getting to 200 or whatever. But that's up to Keshav Maharaj. We don't really know what his drive and motivation is.
What did you say? You said another 30 matches, right?
I said if he gets to play another 30 matches, which would be four to 5 years, I'm guessing, for South Africa.
He's averaging 3.2 wickets a game, which for a South African spinner is probably fairly, like even in his situation, is probably pretty normal. Obviously, it's not what we expect for spinners from other parts of the world. If he plays 30 more matches, he's on par to get about 98, 99 wickets based on what he's done so far. So that gets him to 270, right? So if he plays 25 more matches, we would expect him to be around that 250 mark.
Yeah. And that also depends on how frequently he is picked, because there will be certain
services. They are playing, he's available, like that with South Africa.
They are not playing the SA20 and all of their players are available for the series. Like, there's so many kind of variables over here. But I mean, I think he might be the sort of guy who would carry on considering how his spot is not, you know, in danger at all. And he's a shoo-in, one of the first names on the team sheet in most conditions. The only conditions where that isn't the case is where seam bowlers like completely dominate, right? So
Yeah, he only played two tests last year. Right?
And the West Indies ones this year, right?
Yeah, and he's played three this year and he played 10 the year before. So, you know, I'm not sure how many more years we'll ever see South Africa play 10 tests, let alone him.
Yeah.
But if he gets a couple of years where they play 7 and 8, and especially if they're playing in Asia or anywhere else where he's, as long as he's available. But there are, the reason we put all those caveats on is because there are those caveats out there. We don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. We can only project and make an educated guess, which is what we did. Jared said 250. I said, if all things go to plan, maybe 100 more test wickets. But you guys should let us know in the comment section below how many wickets you think Keshav Maharaj will end up with in test cricket.
And if you get it exactly right, Bayram will send you his mango.
Yes, I will. I'll send, not that mango, but I will send you a mango from Pakistan. Okay? But anyway, yeah, let us know your other thoughts as well, where he ranks, in South Africa's list of or in their history of spinners, because there are quite a few good ones back in the day, right? The Reggie Schwartz and Bert Vogler era. But yeah, we hope that you enjoyed this podcast. Just a quick reminder to everybody, you can go to goodareas.co and bookmark that webpage. It can prove to be your one-stop shop for all the work that we do as part of our team, whether it be written content, videos, and podcasts. And yeah, we'll see you soon. We're recording Footmarks episodes in bulk these days. There's already another one in the offing, which will be recorded soon. So enjoy this one. Give us your feedback and have a good week or days, whatever it is ahead. We'll see you soon enough. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bayram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, you will need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up great clips from your podcast chats and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.